Sessionable.
Welcome everyone to Sessionable. We are here in Marrickville in a very nondescript warehouse.
That means we're at a brewery, right?
Yeah. Right across from the Factory Theatre, I think.
The back of it, at least.
Yeah. The back of it, yeah.
And me and Liam are joined by Topher from Wildflower.
Hey. There you go.
Pretty good, bro. How are you?
Yeah, how are you?
Can't complain. Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for letting us come around.
No worries. Yeah. Any excuse to open a few beers?
You've done a bit of work since the last time I've been here.
Yeah, last time you came here, there was no electricity. So clearly, there's been a little bit being done. But yeah, I've done some stuff to try to make it a place where people can come and enjoy a beer, but also try to not mess it up, because it's a really nice little factory.
It is really cool, yeah.
1890 metal foundry, so there's a lot of character in it already, so the intention is to kind of be as hands-off or to intervene as little as I can in how it already is. So, yeah.
Awesome. So, Topher, I guess this is like the one time we can do a podcast where you can tell us your origin story, because it is you starting a new brewery. So,
true.
Before Wildflower, do you want to tell us how you started getting into beer and
I was born
that long rope? Yeah.
No, so I'm originally from Texas, which is why my accent's really, really messed up.
It is pretty messed up.
It's really I get it everywhere. Anyway, yeah, I moved out here in 2009 initially. Did my high schooling in America, finished that off, and then moved out. And in my first trip over, just traveling, met my now wife. And then that made Australia a viable option to stay in the future. So anyway, moved to Australia. I started my degree here. I studied astrophysics at Sydney Uni and really enjoyed that. And you're going to get a sample of my daily audio.
Yeah.
Sorry about the planes.
It seems like a flight path is necessary for a really good brewery. So
yeah, I mean,
I think you're doing well.
Or cheap rent.
Yeah, or cheap rent. Why not both?
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I finished my degree. While I was studying my degree at Sydney Uni, I was playing lacrosse at the Rocks. There's a group of expat Americans that plays lacrosse, like box lacrosse there. If you don't know what lacrosse is, go watch American Pie, and that'll give you a horrible representation of it, but at least you have a little more understanding. Andrew Finneran and Chris Sidwa were also players there, and we had been friends for a while, and they knew I was homebrewing for a while. And so they were starting this new brewery called Batch, and they were like, hey, do you want to help out? So about 6 months before they started and 6 months before I finished my degree, I started helping out over there and building stuff and whatever when it was just an empty warehouse there too. And started with them, you know, when they started. At the same time when I finished my degree, started brewing for Flat Rock, which was a little bit closer to where I was living, which was awesome. Love that place so much. And yeah, sort of got my feet wet, and that was the intention, was just to have a little bit of fun, because I was always going to go back and do my PhD. That was always the
case. So it's just a bit of a summer break while you...
It was like a summer break in a year.
Just to chill out after, yeah.
My wife and I were pretty keen to move to Europe, which we ended up doing. So it was like, oh, we'll make some money on the side, because there's no money in research. Well, very little,
at least.
There's
no money in beer either, but hey.
At least it pays, right?
Yeah,
research doesn't. So anyway, yeah, I got my feet wet. And by the time I left Batch to go to Europe at the end of 2015, at the end of 2014, Chris was looking at me being like, he just shook his head smiling. He's like, you're not going to go to your PhD. And while I was over there, I realized, you know, he was right. Yeah, so I decided to get back into this. So in a roundabout way... I just, you know, I've came from the sort of analytical background, and initially applied that to the beers that I was making, and really enjoyed everything that I did. But I, you know, at the end of the day, the beer, which was a little bit more fun to do than studying, won out. So yeah, that's a bit of a part of my background. But mm-hmm. Yeah, not to go too far into it, that would be an interesting brewing part. Anyway.
So, where upon the line did your interest in mixed ferment or different fermentations come into play? Was it something you were always interested in, or
No, it wasn't. Not at all. I didn't even know about it.
Yeah.
For a long time. It's hard to pin down because it's such a slow progression.
Yeah.
I think I was reflecting on recently in writing the blog article that I put up on the blog for Wildflower.
Firstly, what do you call it? Like,
what do I do?
Yeah, yeah.
Mixed fermentation.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So mixed culture fermentation or mixed fermentation. It's any fermentation that uses more than just clean Saccharomyces to do the fermentation. So where I got into that, I think, was I was reflecting on this, trying to pinpoint where it was, and I think a lot of it has to come. A lot of it came from my interest in going back to the origins of everything. A lot of things that I do outside of beer, I try to go back literally to raw materials, to scratch, and figure out how these things were made back before the advent of plastic or like the advent of so many different things.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of commodities that we have now that we're able to be consumers of, but back in the day, a lot of those things were made by artisans or craftsmen who were not only making something beautiful, but also making something functional. And so I generally take that approach. And with brewing, it was something that dawned on me. A friend of mine was opening a brewery in the States, and I was working at Batch at the time. And it dawned on me that basically we had the exact same access to ingredients.
Yeah.
We could buy the same yeast, the same hops, the same malt, basically. Not that we would use them all, but we had access to the same. And something about that just kind of didn't sit right with how I feel. You know, I love the beers that are made with those. But what I wanted to do is just go one step further, I guess, or just delve down a little bit deeper within myself or within the ingredients themselves to find out where they come from. And I was back home in Texas once, and you know, visited Jester King for the first time, and that was clearly it was a massive influence on me, and they continue to be so now.
Yeah.
And just seeing what someone could do and the beers that are possible to make using yeast from your native environment blew my mind and went, okay. And once that can of worms was opened, I fell pretty hard into that.
Is it sort of looking to show a bit of character of where it's coming from? Like, it's a bit more of that wine idea of, you know, like with beers, like you can't drink a beer, go, oh, this beer's from this area or something. With wines, you can get really wanky and go, that's from the right bank.
Yeah. 300 kilometers. It has this terroir to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that word.
Yeah, I do as well.
but is it sort of trying to get some of that identity of where you are into the beers, or
probably
is that
less
just really wanky?
It's probably less. No. I mean, it's not wanky because that's how it was, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, there were communal breweries all throughout northern France that farmers from different areas would. I mean, it's food preservation, really. Like you're taking barley, which is a seasonal crop. And malting it so that it can last a little bit longer, and then you're brewing that for a number of months that they could do without refrigeration, and storing the sugar that was in that, the nutrients, for a little bit longer. So, and one brewer from down the road was doing that for his crop as a preservation. Another brewer was doing it for his preservation, and they had different house cultures.
Like, yeah,
their beer tastes different. So I didn't come about it in trying to use that as a. And I still don't. I don't try to come about that in terms of trying to express terroir in the beer. I love the word terroir because of its association with wine, but I don't grow my barley, so I'm not going to use that for my beer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different concept, and I have way too much respect for winemakers that actually grow their wine, as it were.
Yeah.
And that's not something that I'm going to apply. For me, I think really more of it comes down to the necessity to explore what is in our own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So I came to Australia and was dumbfounded by the beauty of the native ingredients, the native flora, and the native, and now that I found out, the native microflora. And there was just this thought in my mind that went, if there is so much diversity, you know, this is so different between, you know, like continental Europe, North America, South America have so much more equilibrium amongst, you know, mammals and flora outside of Australia. These, like, it's totally different over here than I think probably the yeast might
would
be as well.
As well,
be different,
right?
As well.
Yeah, 100%.
And so it was a desire to explore that. That kind of started it for me. I'm really, really happy to express the ingredients that we have on our back door because I think that's important. But at the same time, I'm probably more focused on finding out what flavors a yeast that is indigenous to Australia is going to give.
Yeah. And how, like, is the yeast behaving the way you thought it would? Did you have any expectation of what was going to come out. How is it going? Like, because it's a bit of an unknown, right?
It's very wild.
Yeah.
And I had a very humbling experience with that. And
was that
DJ
today?
Who's here with us today? No, about a month ago. I've worked at this culture for a while, and I was pretty happy with how it was performing and what the beers were giving out. And I thought, okay, you know, I need to step this up, because with my background in brewing, being professional brewing, I knew that flavors change when you're working at production scale levels. So I was only able to work with this mixed culture that I had foraged and put together. I'd worked that for long enough at a homebrew scale, and I need to scale up, and thus Wildflower. But when I scaled it up, it didn't behave like it did on the small scale. So a lot of my early beers, my beers when they were early, very young in barrel, were presenting a huge amount of sulfur, toilet water stuff, like undrinkable. And DJ was here, and I was like, my hands and my eyes, like,
I'm fucked. Crying.
Like, oh, what have I done? And so luckily I was able to call on, you know, a bunch of support and people that I really respect who are doing mixed culture fermentation, and ask questions and just sort through things. And overwhelmingly I heard, just give it some time, just relax.
Have a bit of patience.
Let what's going to happen, right? There's this amazing blend of yeasts that are able to...
Just doing crazy
not
shit.
Not necessarily self-correct, but they just... It's amazing nature.
It just finds a way
She's an unbelievable creator. Like, when we try to intervene, I think we mess it up more than we make it better.
Yeah, yeah.
So, sat on it, and luckily, you know, a few barrels, like, enough just to blend a little bit of beer, have come through. I mean... Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I'm gonna work with this culture for the next 20 years and figuring out what it is and how I can work with it better and what wort I need to give her in order for them to do their thing the best and express themselves really well. It's just the start. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of beer there, but it's quite humbling. It's very wild. You know, I've got a lot of beer sitting in barrel that right now I would never send out to trade. And I think it's just the nature of what we're doing. We're trying to cultivate a house strain or a house culture out of thin air. Like,
how is
literally.
It? Yeah, literally. No.
And are you, like, kind of, you know, you have this culture that you're trying to work with. Are you planning to increase the amount of different yeasts in there, or are you just going to, like, stick with this yeast right now?
We'll stick with the yeast what we have. The way that we brew with it and the way that you handle yeasts tends to select out certain things, just the way that you do it. So a lot of different breweries that deal with mixed culture fermentations have different yeast handling practices, and that that greatly influences the culture and what populations of what are propagating well. Do I know what's in it? No. I know that it tastes good enough.
So I mean, you'd have some idea, like, it's... Yeah.
I know there's a lot of wild Saccharomyces in it. I know there's a lot of Pediococcus in it. Mm.
There's definitely some Brett there.
There's definitely Brett there, which helps, you know, get some mustiness. Not Brett that I've ever smelled before.
Yeah.
But there's been a few people that are interested in wanting to do that or trying to look at what's in it and propagate things up proportionally. However, I just don't see that as... I see that as kind of beside the point. Like, it's... To me, sensory is everything. Like... Our noses are better than multi-million-dollar machines at picking up different things. And what we do here in splitting up the batches and then blending them back together is a selective process based on sensory. So, you know, if I was focused on creating a full-week turnaround mixed culture beer, then, yeah, I'd really want to know what was in it, and I'd want to be able to replicate that 100 times over. But that's not what we're doing. I mean, trying to take a step back and say, how did these brewers ever create a culture that was drinkable? And
like, how do you sort of steer it into where you want to go to some degree,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And how do I handle it so that it comes out giving me something
that
I want? So it's like I've had to... I mean, I've seen DJ before. It's like, it's really humbling. Like, we've committed ourselves to this culture, and yeah, I'll keep adding stuff to it as I continue going through seasons. And when I see bees on stuff, sometimes I'm like, oh, that might be some good yeast, and I'll capture from that. So, and if it tastes good, which is pretty rare, like 1 in 8 is like, that's generally what I think is good enough to go into the culture. Then I'll keep adding stuff. Absolutely. Like, I completely, I want drift in this. But we, because of what we're doing, it's entirely sensory. And I sort of say sometimes that, I think about it, like, I basically have committed so hard to the raw materials that everything else that we do is just trying to make something that's drinkable out of that.
Yeah.
It's not a great business model, but I would totally recommend it. Like, it's so much fun. And the flavors that Mother Nature creates herself are so much more incredible than something I could force it to do.
Do you struggle, like, giving away control to Mother Nature? Like, with your, you know, with uni and working in commercial breweries and stuff like that, like, where it's all about controlling every single aspect of it. How is it to sort of just let something else decide what your beer is going to be?
I think I did, and then I trust her a whole lot more now. and I've spent time trying to understand what conditions I need to give her in order for her to do her thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's you can't take a bad commercial beer and make good sour beer. Like,
no.
Yeah, it happens.
You're not covering
it. Happens sometimes where it's like, this one tastes a bit weird, right? Let's throw it in barrels and put some lacto in it. Yeah. Let's see what it does. Well, it's not going to happen, right? You know, we make really awesome wort, which we're kind of drinking now, which is basically a clean golden hoppy beer. It's a really nice wort, and then give it to the yeast and then just sit back and be like, what do you reckon about that? Like, what are you going to do with that? I'll put you in some barrels so you can have some micro-oxidation and you can feed on that for a while, and maybe you can do something with it. That's cool. If not, I'll dump you out. But
you can do something cool with it, yeah.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, and that's going to be the experiment that is Wildflower, like, is that commitment to our yeast and figuring out how she wants to go.
So let's talk about the wort. Like, are you brewing the beer initially, and then what are you doing with it afterwards?
So we've adopted a wort contracting model, we might call it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of anyone doing that?
Yeah, before? So we've adopted the same. We've adopted the model from the Rare Barrel or Crooked Stave initially, or Casey Brewing and Blending in Colorado. These guys don't make wort as it were, or they don't have brew houses. Well, Crooked Stave does now, but something that was really important to me at the beginning, and I realized from the beginning, was that in order to do this, you need a lot of stock. You need a lot of barrels, and I'll come around. In order to make a lot of stock, in order to make a lot of wort, you need a big brew house. And to buy a big brew house and to finance that, you need to make a lot of volume. You need to pump stuff out. You need like a commercial timeline.
Yeah.
We can't do that. Like, I don't have a commercial timeline.
How often would you use, if you had a brew house, and how often would you use it?
Like, I need to make like thousands of liters wort at once.
Yeah.
So like once a fortnight? So it's not economical
to have it sitting there dusting over, right?
So instead we set up the blendery, if you will, where we are right now, in Merrickville, which is, you know, a bit of a hub for breweries. And currently I've been making my wort at Batch, where I used to work, and those guys are good friends of mine still. They're gracious enough to let me use their brew house when they're not using it. So I brew up 1,200 liters of wort, or 1,300 liters of wort at a time, and then bring it to where I am in a stainless steel sanitized IBC tote. And then I...
Can you explain what a
yeah, is? So, yeah, and IBC is an intermediate bulk container. You might have seen them as sort of plastic ones with cages.
Yep.
Some breweries use them for mashing out. Some farms use them for, like, water collection. So it's that size, but all stainless steel. It's an American manufacturer. A lot of breweries in the States are using them for sour beer, fruit beer ferments, and all kinds of stuff. They're just a great little thing. So I knock out sanitarily into that.
Yeah,
and then I drive it over here, which takes about 3 minutes.
Is that just in the back of the ute?
Yes.
You just drive the forklift down.
No, I have thought about that. Yeah.
I had that image in my head.
No, I haven't done that yet, but there's always tomorrow. So it's on the back of a ute, and luckily there's a few utes that will be able to hold that. And then I lift it up on the forklift, and it gravity feeds into my wide shallow fermenters, and then I inoculate it there with my house culture of yeast and do it from there. So and then it ferments from there, and blah, 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 the process begins of how we make our beer. But the important part was is that we couldn't afford a brew house and the time required to make these beers. Our fastest beer that goes into oak, that goes out to trade, is a four-month turnaround. And so when you're looking at a lot of beers being to 3 weeks, it's quite generous turnaround, cash flow can become a huge issue. So our capital couldn't be spent on investing in stainless steel. Our capital is literally in rent.
And
barrels and barrels. Time. I mean, yeah. Which is really costly.
Yeah.
So we had to reject that.
It goes against modern breweries. Like, everyone's like, get it in, get it out fast, let's get it ticking over. So just sort of, it's the opposite of that, right?
Yeah, a little bit. But if those guys weren't there, then I wouldn't be able to make my work. You know, I needed, and also if the industry wasn't at the stage where it is, I don't know if a brewery like mine could succeed. So, and that has yet to be seen as well. Hopefully it succeeds.
Yeah.
Hopefully it succeeds. Yeah. We all hope.
So you consider, or you brew your own wort, so you
so I make
bar
it.
A brewery.
I make
and
it.
And this is a barrel room, or
we've called it Wildfire Brewing and Blending.
Yeah.
I don't know what we call. I mean, the brewing process is a 6-hour part of what is for me a 4-month. Journey.
It's a minuscule part of the whole journey, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So the fastest.
But it is what people, I guess, what people would focus on at the moment would be that 3-4 hours.
I mean, that's the sexy part. That's where you put the chocolate malts and the hops and whatever. And for me, that's just not our focus. Like, it absolutely is.
It's a means to an end to you, I guess.
Yeah, I need to make the work because I need to ferment it. I need to, you know, have it so I can, you know, do stuff later with it. So. Anyway, it is a bit of a mainstream end, but those things, the malt is really important to me based on, because it's all from New South Wales. I want to use what we have, but it's not the major part. I mean, here's my recipes. Gold is 70% ale malt and 30% raw wheat. Amber is half a bag of chocolate and the exact same thing at 6%. And the table beer is a 3% beer that has one bag of wheat and then the rest ale malt. So.
Yeah.
And one's hopped to 25, one's hopped to 18, and one's hopped to 35.
But that's not what makes your beer special, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, it's cold side. That's where the magic happens, as it were. You know, and that's where I want to give Mother Nature her time to be able to do whatever she will. So, that's far more important to me in what we're doing. And I think it's necessary for what we're doing. Again, we've committed to the ingredients, so I have to do everything that we do.
Yeah.
You know, it's
and so Voyager malts or
Voyager and Provenance.
Yeah.
So John Campbell. So Voyager's Stu Whitcross and his mate out of the Riverina. And get a lot of specialty malt from them. Like the chocolate I get from them, and then some Vienna. They had fresh, so I was like, okay. Well,
and you raw wheat and stuff like that?
Raw wheat comes from John Campbell, who he's actually he's in the flour game more, and he supplies this Spitfire, a really hard protein wheat to Brickfields and Brasserie Bread.
Ah, right.
And so out of the exact same plot, the exact same harvest, I get the raw wheat and crack it, and that goes into my beers. And also his base malt. So it's really simple stuff. Sorry if you guys listen, it's amazingly complicated, beautiful malt. Yeah. It's what we have, right? And so it just makes sense.
It's a feel though,
that.
Right?
I mean...
But you've obviously thought about who you're not just going to Joe White and getting a bag of Pilsner malt.
You know, these people are buying, I feel like the consumers are buying, some of them are buying craft beer because they want to support their local communities and they want to see microeconomies rather than everything go to macroeconomies.
Yeah.
And so it's silly for us to attempt to buy at volume from macro things and then sell our beer at micro prices. We're committed to them because they need us and we need craft maltsters in order to
and for you to have a direct line and be able to see where it's grown and all that stuff as well, and speak to the people who are harvesting your grain and
or malting it or everything.
Yeah.
It's so good. And I love calling Stu and being like, hey, what's in? He's like, oh, what? Got some Munich now. And I'm like, yeah, set it up. Like, I'll use it in the Ember. Like,
yeah.
Whatever. Like, it's not Vienna. Okay, yeah, send it. Like, it's not... Yeah, I'm less... Very, very, very... I'm not so focused on that recipe thing. I'm more focused on where it comes from, but not percentages of this and that.
And what about hops? What are you doing with hops?
Hops, so... Yeah, it's a tough one. So, hops, right now, we're using New Zealand Motueka and Czech saws. I'm really married to Noble hops at the moment, Noble style.
Are you aging hops? Are you drying hops?
I do have some aging up there, but I'm not adding any to the worts at the moment. I have in the past, and it's awesome flavors. Yeah. I really like them. But
looking for some hop character.
Favorite styles, like what I'm really going for specifically in the gold is something that's got an awesome fresh hop character with something. At the same time, blended into it, that's got a nice barrel character and a little bit of age on it. So something that's in between those two, because I love hops. Like, don't get me wrong, they're awesome. Again, there's no the moment that I know of, and please contact me if you know of someone who's making commercial hops in New South Wales. That would be great. And my, you know, I have gone to New Zealand and to the Czech Republic for that. For me right now, that's something that there's a lot of other variables in my production, and I've tried to stick with a few things. That's just one thing that I do know can perform.
Yeah.
And Hop Products Australia are doing some awesome things with a lot of their hop varietals, but they're also dropping like Noble hop character varietals, so like Summer won't be around in a few years, which is Australian saws. And
so that's just following that's the trend to some degree.
Yeah,
right?
It's like, yeah. Oh, rip that out and plant more Galaxy, which yeah. I don't want Galaxy character in mind. It might be.
Well, you don't, but other people do.
Other people do. Yeah. But yeah. So
yeah.
The moment, and we'll get there. Like, I that's another thing that I really want to bring into the fold. Right now, there's just so many other variables that I was like, okay, I need to.
You need to pick your battles to start with, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it is something that it does sort of nig me at night. I'm like, you know, could have done this, but we've really extended ourselves in doing this. And like, to be totally honest, I've heard other business owners saying this when they open, and they're like, you know, I really hope this works out because, like, we're, you know, if it doesn't, like, things aren't going to look so awesome.
Yeah.
That's a real feeling that I feel now. And before I was like, oh, you're a craft brewer, you'll be fine. You'll open beer, you sell, people love it. And now I'm like, no, I know where they're at because it's risky. And so,
well, if you've got a barrel that you're thinking I'm going to have to dump, that's like you're counting dollars right there, right?
Yeah.
No,
I need to dump. Yeah. Don't worry about that.
Just praying that one day they might just fix themselves. Yeah.
but also the hops aren't a major point of this beer, you know.
No.
And these beers at all. I mean, it's yeast character and blending is the most important parts.
Do you want to talk to us a little bit about the beer that we're drinking now?
Yeah, well, why don't I get the next one?
Yeah, we'll take a quick break and we'll do that. Yeah, sweet. Yeah,
cool.
Sessionable.
All right, we're back.
Thanks for the break. Sorry, I grabbed a beer in the meantime to contrast the two. So the first beer that we were drinking was my gold wort fermented with my mixed culture straight into bottle. So it's not a beer that will release commercially from the start. And maybe we will eventually, I'm not sure, but it's just an interesting contrast to what we're going to have now, which is a still barrel sample that's cold, basically, which is the exact same wort, finished fermented with the exact same yeast, but had, at that stage, I think 6 weeks in oak. So really not a whole lot of time, but I mean, these guys could probably explain it better than I could on air. There's a huge difference between the two.
I've just smelt it, and there's a massive difference.
Yeah, no, I'm about to taste it. I've only smelt it so far.
Color, you can see straight away, big difference.
A little bit darker, mm-hmm. A little bit of oxidation.
It's a bit drier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'd pick that up. Yeah, for sure.
A bit of citrus acid as well.
Yeah, I get a lot of citrus, like a lot of lime.
Yeah, big time.
And that tartness, it's really the mixed culture going to work. If it had more pressure, it was still quite young at that stage. So this barrel I'm actually blending, and it's going to be in the first blend. But it's at this, it's developed even further from there. I mean, I could go pull a barrel sample if you want, but yeah, I can taste where it's come from there, and bottling it kind of did freeze that in time a little bit. But you get a lot more character of my culture, which obviously there's a bit of sourness that comes in, even though this is a 25-ish IBU beer. And there's, to me, like a PDO character in that sourness, so it's more on the side of your of your tongue than right on the top. There's a lot of lime character, which I think comes from the Mochueca, plus the dryness, plus the bit of acid that's there. They all play together and give you that. But generally, it's quite bright, and then the dryness has to do with the fact that we're in, it's pretty still right now. Had it been more carbonated, I just didn't put any sugar in it when I took the sample and bottled it up. I just put it straight in the fridge, put it straight in the bottle and then let it sit there. That would have rounded out a little bit more, and then a little bit more time on oak helps that come out as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an interesting thing to look at. Not a beer that I would release on its own commercially all. You know, right now I don't think it's just interesting to taste and fun to have. I mean, it's for you two, it's probably a good look at what my culture looks like when it's pretty young.
But I mean, I guess the idea is not to just release, you know, single barrel beers, but to release blends that have the flavor profile that you are after.
Yeah.
Which is really cool, because, like, you know, I haven't really seen that outside of Belgium and the US, of people, like, you know, barrel aging and mixing different vintages and whatever to make a final product.
I think it's integral because of our commitment to our yeast. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that. Like, I couldn't just release single barrel beers.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe down the road there's some amazing barrel that has this great thing and I want to show that single barrel, but that's not what we do.
Are you seeing any barrels that are starting to stand out?
It's pretty young. No, I mean, there's some that I like, but I wouldn't call that the barrel. It's probably more of the mixture of beer that just goes in there. So the beers that are racked early into barrels have more Saccharomyces in them than the others, than the stuff that comes later in the blend. So there's definitely barrel variation. I think it's way too early of a stage to start calling those kinds of things. I mean, we just earlier today looked at all the barrels in the cellar, and it was so good to look at them one by one, and per batch I'd be able to
And how
to
much
see,
variation is there?
I mean, look, if you'd never tasted the beers before, it'd be tough to tell.
Yeah.
But when they're sitting there side by side,
you can
there's a lot. So the stuff that gets racked later, for instance, so the young stuff, sorry, just to explain this a little bit more, when I rack into barrel from the fermenter, the stuff on the bottom is sitting closer to the yeast cake, and Saccharomyces grows exponentially in early stages of fermentation. So the stuff that's on the bottom that gets racked into barrel first, that beer has a higher concentration of Saccharomyces in it. And those beers
conventional beer yeast, you could say, almost. Yeah.
Conventional beer yeast, some of it is the
but it's
yeast,
all wild, it's wild strains of Saccharomyces there, right?
There are some wild Saccharomyces. There's also a primary strain of a clean Saccharomyces beer.
Right.
So it's a Belgian strain
that
I put in with there. I mean, that's a practice that I borrowed from Jester King, so they do it.
So it's just
it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me.
The starting point for the yeast to do something.
Yes, it's just
the other stuff to
it's
kick
the
off
workhorse for everything else to get going. So anyway, the stuff that racks out first has a higher strain of population of Saccharomyces, whereas the stuff that comes later is more of the yeast and bacteria and bugs that are still in suspension, and they don't have as much Saccharomyces in the blend, in the barrel, as it were. And those barrels get more sick, so they're showing more signs of Pediococcus development. So right now, they're not something I would blend with right now. Give them a month, give them 6 months, give them a year. It depends on how they want to go. Those are going to be interesting barrels. So I'm happy that there is these variations amongst each batch, and I see that, you know, it's the exact same yeast into barrels that are neutral. Like, none of these barrels have treated any differently.
Yeah.
And there's no residual flavor from what was in there before. That's really important to me. So different batteryation has to come from different populations of yeast and bacteria in the actual barrel. So
yeah,
and that's good. I mean, part of what we're doing here, if people support us from the start, then we're going to be able to get better.
It's a journey, right?
It's absolutely a journey. It's a journey for our cellar. It's a journey for me. It's a journey for the people that are drinking
but
our beer.
But for punters to come in, they can, as they come in once a month or every 2 months, and it's going to change as well. You can see that,
Yeah, so, it's not going to change. Like, there's going to be hallmark. I mean, if you go back to that beer that we just opened, the flat one, like, now that it's saddled around a little while.
Really, it's
like,
really good.
That's exactly what my culture does. That's exactly what it does.
Yeah.
So give this a little time to mellow out. And a little more time, boom, and I blend that with that fresh saison that we had before. Yeah. That's what I want. I mean, if anyone's had BFM Square Root 225 saison, that's my ideal beer. It's this beautiful length beer. It's got like a really nice hop aroma at the start, and then it's got this length of balanced acidity throughout. It's never sharp. It's always rounded. And it's creamy. It's beautiful. Like it pairs with so many foods, and that's where I want to get to, and that's where I think blending offers you that opportunity. So you have variations amongst barrels, but each blend is to my palate, and so there's a consistency that goes out to the public. That's like, I think this is the best example of my cellar at the moment, and so that's what we send out, and that's what we'll continue to do. Like, I want the yeast to express itself differently. I want it to drift. I want to add more cultures to the strain. When it's in winter, it's going to ferment differently than when it's in summer. I want to see that because I feel like that's where we get the most. Well, that's where Mother Nature has the most fun. Like she creates the most new flavors for us. And
I was going to ask about that.
Have a look at.
Like how did you find? Because we've had a pretty hectic summer, right?
Yeah.
How have you found that? How have you managed that? And how's that changed things?
So there's about 2 months, I think, 2.5 months in Sydney that you need to be worried about barrel-aged beer.
And I think we've just got through
that.
It's been fucking hectic as well.
In order for me to get through that, I put my first beer in barrels, and then like I looked at the forecast, and a few days later it was going to be one of those days this summer was like 45 in the West or something stupid. And I was like, oh my God, like, what am I going to do? So my dad was out and I roped him and we drove out to, I can't remember, somewhere in the hills, and picked up this like big air conditioner. And I just put it on a pallet and insulated this back area of the brewery, which is going to be my warm room, and put the barrels in there.
Ghetto cool room.
Yeah, exactly. My ghetto cool room. And because there was only, you know, 5, 10, 15, 25, like those are each batch adding 5 more barrels, 25, 30 barrels, it was a space that I was able to manage.
Yeah.
It might sound just silly that I didn't think about that before. I had thought about it, but I was like, you know what, like, I want to embrace Australian climate, and then it was like 45. I was like, nah, can't embrace Australian climate. Like, I need to make some beer that's going to be drinkable. You know, I can't have nail polish in all of my barrels. So that's how we got past it this first year. And you know, again, we're me and my brother-in-law are the only two. That's it in the business. You know, there's no one else that's a part of it. And so it means that we can make all the decisions and I can make sure that the beer is the way that I want it to be every time we send it out, and we all have to answer to ourselves. But at the same time, that also means we're not swell with cash. So by next summer, you know, by now in the next few weeks, the barrels will be able to come out of that space and there's not going to be a problem with that. And we'll be able to make it through the winter and the next fall. But by summer next year, we'll have a solution for this whole
Is it a thing where if you can get to a point, you just don't brew for a couple of months, or?
Well, we still have the barrels then, though.
Yeah, well, you still got to worry about the barrels, right? Yeah.
So I've got to at least have somewhere to put them, which we could do. I mean, I don't like.
Do you want to do like one of those really cheesy like ice bars? Like, you can have glasses made of ice and.
No. Nah, it's the barrels. I like warm beer and cold barrels. No, good barrel aging temperature is around, as long as the beer stays below like 23, 22, you'll be fine.
And not that you need to worry about it in Sydney, but going the opposite way and getting too cold.
Well, no, that's not a problem.
Can you have issues with like chill haze or anything like that?
Would it just take a bit longer?
Just take longer. I mean, think about Belgian.
Yeah, it's like, cold.
Lambic producing. Yeah. I mean, that's generally a lot of lambic producers say the beers need to go through one summer and they need to go through one winter.
Well, it just sort of makes me think about like whiskey, and then like, you know, places like India and other stuff, they can produce some like whiskey like quite young with a lot of depth because it's so fucking hot
that
it's basically speeding up the process, and like they lose a lot to evaporation in barrels, so the barrel loss is very high, but they get a really
But the maturation happens really quickly.
It's kind of like Australian whiskey, right? Like they're finding that in like Victorian stuff because it's a bit warmer than your usual whiskey temperatures.
Well, if you think about Scotch whiskey, like you know,
it's cold up there.
If you're on the island, you're literally on the coast, 12 years minimum. So is there anything like that? Is that affecting your beers at all?
Look,
I mean, speeding up's probably not the right word, but
like the beer that we're tasting right now only spent 4 weeks in oak, and there's a pretty significant acid contribution to that. That was during the hotter months. It was air conditioned during that, and the beer never got above 25 degrees. But there's a general rule in chemistry that all biological processes happen a certain amount faster per a certain degree, higher. Some chemist is going to pull me up on that, but there's something like that, right?
Well, it's time and heat and all this stuff. Exactly. There's relativity, right?
The problem is that as you get hotter, there's not necessarily chemical processes that you want to happen specifically in beer. So there's
a lot of our flavors and
let's talk in a year.
Yeah.
And I know my culture and I know my barrels and I say, things slowed down or they sped up and I liked this and like in the winter it's going to slow down, but what that's going to allow for is it's going to allow for different populations of different types of bugs to come to the fore and do their thing. So there's going to be a difference in winter beer versus summer beer, and I'll blend those barrels based on winter or summer or whatever in order to create a product that you know what you're getting. So when you buy our beer, you know, blend one, blend two, blend 25, you should be able to put them next to each other and close your eyes and go, that's still a Wildflower beer. But each blend is going to be a representation of the best beer that I had on hand. It's not necessarily the exact same beer. It's just going to be the best stuff that
it's showing well at that point.
But there's going to be a clear demarcation between it and any other wild fermented beer. Like it's like any brewery. I mean, you talk to any brewer, they know their beer better than anyone else because they're tasting it day in, day out. I'll taste the variation and I'll try to basically, if it's a good variation, well, I seem to think that if it's a drinkable variation, they're all good. But I want to be able to produce something that someone knows what they're getting. So they're not opening blend 16 and it's a whole different beer than blend 15.
Hopefully someone that knows your beers, give it to them blind and they'll go, that's it. That's one of Topher's. It's a wildflower.
I think right now, if you smell that...
They're two very different beers, but there is a commonality between the two of them.
Well, that one had no time in oak. The one that didn't go into oak had its commonality, but the one that was in oak, what you're smelling there is probably going to be the hallmark smell of my aged beers for a while until that changes. And that's I think it's interesting. I think it's kind of fun. A little bit of that, because that beer is very young, a bit of time breathing is really good for it.
Yeah.
But that's going to be that is it. And I think that worldwide, if I was to take this beer to friends in Europe or in America and open it alongside their beers made from their native microflora, it would be significantly different. And that doesn't mean that one of them is world-class and one of them is not. It just means that we literally have harvested different things from our different areas.
Yeah.
And that's what we're interested in exploring. I'd love to be able to get good enough with my culture and my beer in order to make something that is world class. I mean, that's my goal. I'm not doing this for
shits and giggles.
I want to make great beer.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, where it's starting, you know, first iterations, I'm like, okay, this is a good place to start.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We'll go from there. So.
So what is your kind of starting strategy? Like, you know, you haven't released a beer yet, but I mean, like, you know, are you going to like stay local to begin with?
Where is it going to be?
What's gonna happen?
It'll definitely be
here. Where can we get it?
Yeah,
definitely here.
Yeah,
you know, we'll have a little tap room. Actually, no, that's the worst word because we don't have any taps. Barrel bottling
room.
All of my beer.
Barrel room, tasting room.
Yeah, cellar door. A let's just call it cellar door. That way people know it. Definitely be here. We'll make sure that there's enough here to keep that going. So we're bottling. I'm actually bottling tomorrow, and our beers are bottle conditioned for 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So
4 weeks.
So math. So we're looking at April to open this.
Okay.
And how many? How much bottles are you doing tomorrow? How many beers are you bottling?
1,000 bottles.
Hand bottling, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
So we have a wine filler, like a wine gravity filler.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is used amongst the industry for beers like this, and then a pneumatic capper, stainless steel caps with these awesome oxygen scavenging, yeah, super well sealed
caps.
Excuse me, inserts. and yeah, they'll sit down really well.
And they're all like champagne bottles and stuff.
Yep, yep. All 750.
Yeah, they're thick bottles, aren't they?
Yeah, they're big ones.
You kind of need that for secondary,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. We're not going to, like, I like fluffy beer. Like,
yeah.
What we're drinking right now is basically still and cold.
Yep.
I really like it when they're kind of like bursting in your mouth a little bit. So we'll carbonate to, you know, 2.8, 3 volumes on the higher end. So not quite Orval-esque, but more on that era than, you know, your normal ales. So,
and what
yeast
are you using for your secondary?
We'll recondition with the same yeast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So,
awesome.
So if you want to, you collect the yeast and make your
own
beer.
So you're not too precious about...
Not at all.
Someone harvesting yeast? Yeah.
No, go for it. Go for it. Yeah. I mean, that's how I learned to brew. Like,
I guess, like, all the Belgian brewers that kind of left all their yeast in bottles, they were like, whatever.
Yeah, and then
I don't give a shit.
Well, in 1,000 years, your great-great-great-grandson can worry about people trying to steal this ancient yeast, I guess. But.
Go get your own yeast. No, it'll be more interesting.
Yeah.
No, I've seen you, like, coming back from your hunting and collecting. You look like a crazy old lady with this, like, grandma shopping trolley with sticks and sticks and stuff.
It's fun. It's awesome. If using my yeast gives you a little more confidence to be able to do that, awesome. You know, I've the only reason I'm able to do this is because I've been entrusted with a shitload of knowledge from people that I really trust who are doing this already. People who are really open and who, you know, I literally call on a daily basis and be like, I don't know what's going on, and then they help me. And it's so hypocritical of me to not do the same
thing. To pass it on to the next person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I've been doing this for, 2 years, partly commercially, and 5 months professionally. So I am not the oracle of mixed fermentation beers, but there's a few things that I've seen that if I'm in trouble, then...
You know a shitload more than we do, so...
Give me a call. Like, I'd love to try to help you out. If I can't, then I'll tell you, honestly, like, I have no idea. That sounds really weird. Like, could be cool, but... I've never heard of that before. So
the wild ferment version of IT support, instead of have you turned it back on and off again, it's like, just give it time.
That's generally what I'll say. Just give it some time. Message me in a month. No.
Turn it off. Turn it off and on again.
not quite. But honestly, you know, I think I do also see that, you know, in Australia, where there's not a whole lot of us doing this. And, you know, Ash has been really, really helpful for me in understanding sort of some of the wild yeast that he catches and works with. And I think it would be so silly of us to not try to help people in doing this. I mean, if it means there's less bad beer produced, everyone's better for that, you know?
I mean, like, it goes against the grain of the beer industry in Australia as a whole, which is very supportive and collaborative and...
Yeah.
And then when you take this smaller segment, when you could probably count on one hand how many people are doing the type of things that you guys are doing, it's just so counterproductive to not help each other out, right? And just start a flow of conversation between the same people doing similar things.
Yeah, and generally this kind of stuff starts at homebrewing levels.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, that's where people are comfortable with risking that amount of wort or...
20 litres or 23 litres versus 120.
So if you do something that I've never done, shit, I can learn from you. That's awesome. Like that's what we need. And if that
But homebrewers have always been the innovators.
They've always been innovators. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So sorry, I'm not speaking directly to
homebrewers. No, I don't think you are at all.
If there's a commercial brewery that's out there doing stuff like this, like, God, like, please get in contact, because, like, I'd love to be able to use you as a reference point if something goes wrong for me. Like, I honestly just don't think that we can operate in silos, especially when we're dealing with something that's so wild as this. And Adrian, you asked before, like, what's the plan? What are we doing? I'm releasing 3 beers for, like, a while. That's it.
Yeah.
And they're beer de coupage versions of themselves. So they're blended versions of different batches of the exact same wort.
Yeah.
Because there's so much variability in what we do, and that's why we can't operate in silos, because there's so much variability in what we do. I really want to try to understand what I'm doing first. Like, yeah. I want the yeast to show me, here's how I like to be treated. And I say, okay, all right, we'll treat you like that. And then after a while, I'll be like, hey, can I put some fruit in you? And they're like, yeah, let's do that. Sweet. Okay, sweet. I'll do that. Yeah. like that's really the way I look at it. Like, I'm focusing on a gold beer, I'm focusing on an amber beer, and I'm focusing on a table beer.
Yeah.
And the table beer doesn't go to oak, and it's not blended. It's just straight to bottle. But those things, there's it might seem very simple from the outlook, from the outside.
Yeah.
But amongst that, there's so much difference happening that I can't, with any confidence, start putting out a bunch of different beers and make them all drinkable.
How different are each blend? Like you mentioned before, like blend one, blend two. Are you going to label it as such?
Yeah, they'll have the same label. They'll be called the same thing. And please check them in on Untappd as the exact same beer, for the love of God.
No, because uniques, man.
Okay, fine. Whatever, Adrian. I'll merge them from the brewery account.
Oh, no! My unique count is suffering.
Anyway,
never coming here again.
No, so I don't know. I mean, I hope like the only thing I can guarantee is that each blend is going to be the best beer that we have, and then that's going to be it. So it's going to be there's going to be consistency amongst the culture, and there's going to be variability amongst the culture, and each blend will be slightly different. But also, if you try to take blend one, which will be packaged tomorrow, and then we try to pick blend two, which will probably package mid to late March. If you set them next to each other and try to drink them together, by the time blend two comes out, blend one's already got 5 weeks more age on it. And there's variability amongst the bottle because of the way that we bottle condition. So it's going to be tough to put them. So you know, it's going to take someone to really understand.
But that's fucking genius,
because
you can't just go like, oh, I fucking had that before. It's like, well, you had a bottle of that. Have another one. It's going to be heaps fucking different. Like,
yeah.
That's not by intention. This is the way it is. Really, I mean.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, it's kind of like that Fantôme thing. It's like, you don't really know what you're going to get when you crack a Fantôme.
Okay, that's not what I'm going for.
No.
I mean, I'll hold myself. Fantôme is probably one of my favorite breweries. Yeah. And if I could replicate anything that they do amongst any of the mystery, like, I would love to.
But there's
to,
so much
like,
variation bottle to bottle.
Fantôme is it's so kind of lucky dip, man.
It is.
That's
it's funny because if for any other brewery, I'd be like, no, you got to have some consistency. But I actually, like, it's...
Yeah.
No,
those styles of beers, like, you know what? I like that about it.
If variability is similar to vintage in wine, so different vintages create different flavors, that's okay.
Especially like after a certain age.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't mind variability in ingredients or in that. I do mind variability in quality.
Yeah,
and that's a different thing, right?
Absolutely not what's going to happen here.
Yeah,
so if you buy it, you're not taking lucky dip in whether it's going to be good or not.
You're not brewing like super dry hopped IPAs that, you know, the hops are going to degenerate after a month or whatever.
No.
You're brewing...
Or it's not going to be like one blend. I'm like, oh shit, I didn't have anything, so I'll throw this vinegar in there, basically.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen. Like, that goes down the drain. So that's
all of that acetic acid.
Yeah.
Acetic acid is a horrible off flavor in mixed culture beers, and it shouldn't be present. Just gonna put that one out there.
So, Adrian asked before, and I'm gonna not let you get out of that one. Where will people be able to get your beers? You mentioned being able to get it from here. And I know it's early days. And you know, you're not, you haven't pre-sold a whole bunch of stuff, but
I haven't pre-sold anything.
Where do you want your beers to be?
So that's a really good question, because it's.
It's not going to be like a go to your local Uncle Dan's and pick up a bottle of a Wildflower. Like, yeah.
It has a lot to do with the style of beer that we make, where we want it to be. So we're bottling all of our beer because I enjoy drinking this style of beer when I eat food. And I enjoy drinking this style of beer when I'm with other people and I enjoy other people. So
it's a sharing
thing. We're packaging it 750ml bottles. You open it up and pour it and have it with your friends while you're having a dinner. So
we're thinking like what, like Three Hat Restaurants and shit like that?
If they want to call me.
Hey. I think it could work in those places because, that's the kind of shit that, you know, that's the kind of wines that people go for.
I don't want to... I'm not saying it should be anywhere. It just should be where people are enjoying themselves and where they're eating good food.
Yep.
But that's a good context to be able to do it, right?
That's a great context for it.
Yeah.
So,
better than sitting at a pub with a schooner in hand.
I mean, nothing wrong with that.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah, yeah. And, like, I'm wearing a Live Oak Pilsner hat right now. Like, I love me a good...
Just easy good, drinking good like, beer.
Absolutely.
That you can smash with friends, right?
Absolutely. And this isn't meant to be that much different, what we're doing, honestly. At the end of the day, the first time you open the bottle, please pour it into a glass and try it that once. Other than that, drink it from the bottle. I really don't give a shit. Like, like if you want to buy it and take it to the beach and, like, you know, let it sift in the waves and all of the yeast throw up and be sediment in there and it's cool enough for you to drink and it's 22 degrees, go for it.
You pay for it. You do what you want, right?
Do what you want. Yeah. And also, like... That's just as natural of a situation for it to be in than at table, in my opinion.
Well, think about the way these styles first aired. Like, exactly. You're probably sitting in a fucking barley field somewhere with a fucking the equivalent of a plowman's lunch sandwich in hand. And
So please just don't get pretentious about it. That's the only request I would have. But yeah, I think it suits very well at gastronomic restaurants. Yeah. So through a number of channels, we hope to be having our beer at those places so that wine drinkers, people who are drinking natural wine, which I just opened a bottle of that we're going to try, are brought into the fold of what we call
expanding
craft beer.
Expanding their horizons because into beer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We are a subculture, this craft beer. We tend to prop ourselves up and we think we're so important. At the end of the day, we're like a fraction of a percent of everyone who drinks alcohol.
But I think at the same time, like, you know, on the opposite end of that, like, natural wines are getting beer people into wine. So I think it's a good kind of crossover.
It's also getting wine people into beer. Like, that looks exactly like beer.
It looks that we just poured a natural wine that... what is it?
It's called Memento Mori.
Memento Mori, staring at the sun.
Heathcote, Victoria. It's a skin contact, multi-varietal, white, orange. Yeah. It's a whitish, orangish wine.
It looks exactly like Topher's beer.
it's actually the exact same color.
It's the exact same color.
And, really interesting winemaker. Can't remember his name, Dave. Something or other. I could look it up.
Oh my god.
It's quite herbaceous, actually, isn't it?
Name, but
like, it's almost like it's.
Oh god.
Yeah.
Can I get you another beer real quick? Because this is going to be useful for us.
No, please. Yeah, yeah.
Sessionable. Oh shit, it's raining. So we're in a warehouse, as we've mentioned, and it's a particularly rainy week in Sydney, and now it's just pissing down, and. I think it's a good time for us to talk about our sponsor, Day's Brewery Tours. So yeah, we love Day's Brewery Tours, not only because they employ Liam, but also because they give us money to do this podcast. And without them, we wouldn't be doing as many of these.
And you know what? I reckon on a day like today, there's nothing worse than trying to get from one brewery to another when it's raining.
Yeah.
How much easier would it be if you had a bus that could take you around?
Oh, so. Nice promo, Liam. Nice promo. I like it.
If Dave wants to take me on a brewery tour, I'd happily come. Just haven't been on a brewery
tour
yet.
I'm sure you can blag one, mate.
So what I was about to say was, and I've talked to Topher about this, you know, many a time, but like, I love when we get to this stage where we're sitting right now with a couple of beers and a wine in front of us, and fuck if I could tell what's a beer, what's a wine. All we need now is just a really funky cider, and then we've hit this trifecta where, like, these three different beverages all become one, and the lines are blurred. And so,
the lines definitely get blurred.
Topher and I have been talking about some events that we're going to do down the track, and the idea is, like, you could, this wine we got in front of us, if I didn't watch you pour it out of the bottle and you just said this is something else that's coming out of my barrels, I would have totally believed you. Like,
yeah, it's it would be tough. Like, I mean, sitting next to each other and knowing which is which, power of assumption or whatever it's called, suggestion. The beer that I poured next to it is from one of my barrels where it was a spontaneous culture that a spontaneous beer that I blended with some other beer and put in a barrel. And I opened it before and it was flat, exactly as it is now. Because I just packaged it out of the barrel and went, I wonder what this is going to taste like. And I smelled it and was like, holy crap, this is a lot like an orange wine. You know, it's a bit more... a little more time, a little more acidity on it, it'll really intend to show that. So for what I'm doing, and for where I get inspiration is mostly from this wine world. These guys have been using, or have been intervening as little as they can in the process in order to make something that's an expression of their ingredients. So the places where I get my wine barrels from are mostly mineral intervention winemakers, and they're not pitching yeast. They're just growing good grapes and crushing them gently and allowing them to ferment properly.
With whatever's on the skins.
With what's on the skins.
And that's why skin contact, right?
Because, well, some of that has skin contact. You don't have to have skin contact in order to do that. There's a lot of... I mean, we could have a whole other freaking podcast, not only in a single episode on winemaking procedures.
Maybe we will. Yeah,
I like that idea.
Yeah, I could bring a few people in for sure.
Yeah,
yeah, let's do that. Actually,
I'm down.
This wine's really, really nice.
It's nice. Like,
Memento Mori, staring at the sun. It's really, really nice.
So what I'm getting from this is, like, you know, you get that kind of... It's a white... it's an orange wine, but it's a white wine kind of looking...
It's orangish white. It's not so orange.
It's a white wine looking wine. Mm-hmm. And you get kind of that character from it, but you also get, like, a kind of sharp acidity as well.
Yeah. It does have a nice bite to it, doesn't it? Yeah.
But it's not...
I'm not going to assume to that in this wine. So winemaking happens at a different... So the must of... Well, not necessarily a must, but fresh pressed grapes are quite low in pH. And they're so low that it's really only levels for wild Saccharomyces to initially inoculate. So having Brettanomyces in wild fermented wine is still an off flavor. And I like it at very small levels in wine. And so this one, with the acidity, we're not talking about lactic acid bacteria bringing into this.
Okay.
These are pretty acidic to start with.
Like the grapes.
The grapes themselves.
To begin with,
Table grapes, like what you buy from the supermarket, are totally different than wine grapes.
Yeah.
And these varietals that he's put in here...
it's kind of like you know, commercial
Fiano, Vermentino, and Moscato. Like these, those are some pretty tart varietals.
It's kind of like, you know, commercial cider versus, you know, traditional cider grape, cider apples.
Apple. Yeah. And like some of that natural cider does have lactic acid contributions.
Yeah.
But even when you taste a cider fermented with neutral commercial yeast, it's going to be more tart than a beer fermented with the same yeast. So, the acidity is not coming from a wild...
Yeah, from a wild ferment.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, it is wild fermented. It's not coming from lactobacillus.
Yeah, okay.
But because it's there, it reminds me, and it reminds, I imagine, both y'all, some wild fermented beer.
Yeah, like it's almost like it's been spiced as well. Like,
yeah.
So this beer that you gave us.
So this one, I wanted to open alongside this wine because they're quite different now that I taste them. Now I taste them side by side.
Yeah.
But when I tasted the beer on its own, I went, interesting. Like, that's a little more down the wine track than the beer track. It's a beer that was put into barrel. It was a spontaneous beer that was put into barrel alongside a clean fermented sort of golden beer, and then allowed to age for probably 9 to 10 months. It has on it right now. So on the nose, it still has a lot of young spontaneous flavor or aroma. I've heard a lot of people talk about that Brett character as like a baby diaper character. And if you've had any stuff from Black Project, Spontaneous Sales, you get a lot of that.
Yeah.
It's
got a lot of it's got a lot of like...
I do get that.
Yeah.
And I'm not super well versed in my off flavors these days, but I'm not sure if that's a thing that kind of conditions out as it ages.
It does. Yeah. And I mean, this has more time to go on it. I've just been tasting it throughout. This barrel that we're talking about, this beer that we're talking about, is not something that I'll release commercially. Yeah. It was one of the ones that I did as a test while figuring out which yeast I'm going to use. And that flavor that we're getting is really reminiscent of young lambic. I mean, where we've like I've been and tasted lambic at 8 and 10 months before it's even blended into it to.
Before it's a 1 year old.
Sorry, yeah. Not lambic. Spontaneously fermented beer. I should be very clear. Lambic is only from
the Seine Valley
area outside of Brussels or Paillotenland or however you say it.
Yeah.
So anyway, but that's a really common character, and it's something that might culture out, and I think next to the fruitiness of that wine really stands out. Alone, it does not stand out, but either way, like, it was one that I tasted with a bit of oxidation and a bit of character with it. I went, that's quite fruity as well. Reminds me more
100%,
of a wine. Like, if you didn't know what it was, it would be a little difficult to pick out. But anyway, that was just a bottle that I've taken from a barrel and wanted to show y'all.
That's awesome.
While
thank you.
Drinking this. Yeah. So, you know, again, there's a lot of beer. If you come in here and we're doing a tour, we'll have tours on Saturday mornings where we taste through a range and then we'll go pull some nails.
Yeah.
And we'll taste some beer that's too young to blend.
So you going to have like an actual tasting room or just doing tours?
No, we'll have a tasting room.
Yeah, yeah.
So the idea is right now, and we'll have to see how this works, is to have a bit of a tasting room in the afternoons, and in the morning we'll do a sort of guided tour.
Okay.
Where I'll just come in the morning, you show up at 11 o'clock because that's when your palate's the best. Show up at 11 o'clock and
what happens if they show up and they've got like a latte and a bacon egg roll in hand?
Out.
Before you eat and drink anything.
No.
Yeah.
Don't brush your teeth that morning.
That's gross. Please brush your teeth. No, so what we'll do is we'll end up tasting beers like the one that we're doing now and just to understand why we blend and why we do what we do by looking at beers that aren't mature or that haven't moved through a sickness phase. Because, you know, like anyone who's done off flavor, like William is studying for his Cicerone exam, it's so instrumental to taste bad beer in order to know what good beer is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't think this is any revelation to anyone that knows anything about this. Like, some of our beers go through some weird stuff. Like, times you open those barrels and it's like, whoa, like this is...
That's fucked up.
Whoa, like, that's bizarre. Like, I won't dump this yet, but it might be on the cards to dump. And sometimes they come out of it and sometimes they don't. And that's all right. But either way, it's really important to be able to know those flavors and go, okay, that's what I don't want, you know? So anyway, that's something... So what we're tasting now is again, a still quite young-ish, spontaneous beer that has interesting characters, but especially against the wine, not developed. You know, like it's not nearly as complex, especially in the aroma. The flavor is on point. I really like the flavor.
Agreed.
It's got a lot of body and nice.
But I totally get why you're pouring this next to this wine as well, because the palate weight's very similar. The acidity level is quite similar as well. Yeah. And like,
Yeah, so this is what I'm thinking.
That, yeah.
Like, in a few months, could be at the stage where we could confuse some people with it.
Where are you getting your barrels from?
So I said before, they're coming from winemakers, minimal intervention winemakers in Orange.
So they're ex-wine barrels?
They're ex-wine.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Ex-wine barrels from winemakers in Orange, New South Wales.
And you're doing that because you're looking to have minimum impartation from what's been in it before?
Yeah,
but still some culture and...
No.
Are you steaming it?
I bought a very expensive piece of equipment from the wine world called the Total Concept Barrel Washer. It connects to a pressure washer, and I spray the barrels like 4,000 psi with hot water.
Yeah,
and it ends up stripping most of the flavor, actually all the flavor out of it.
I strip a lot of color out of it as well.
Yeah, no, I don't get any color pickup.
Yeah.
At all. And if you come into the tap room, we're sitting on chairs right now that are red wine barrels, and the staves themselves are quite stained red. However, because of the treatment that the barrels have had, they're not the beer doesn't.
It's not picking up any red. Yeah,
And that's intentional. Like I love wine so much, and I learn so much from tasting wine, and I love beer so much. So I'm happy for them to be two different.
Yeah.
Drinks.
Yeah. Cool.
And I'm not interested in making.
You can blur the lines other ways, like we're trying now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Making this really traditional wine and show something interesting. So, to get back to the question, though, the wine barrels come from Orange, They're all French oak.
Yeah.
Which is important for what we're doing.
But we're not getting a lot of that vanilla coming through.
The vanilla comes more from American oak and charring, mostly. So those are things that I'm not interested in these beers. As you can taste, they're quite delicate. Like, there's some nuance in the yeast aroma. So we're if we were throwing in a big kick-ass oak barrel in with that, it would probably cover all of those flavors up.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at barrels as a vessel rather than a flavor component. It's something that allows me
enough
to have
oxygen and enough things to happen.
A micro-oxidation. Yeah. Over a diverse surface area.
Yeah.
So it's not something you can replicate in stainless.
Yeah.
The micro oxidation, and so that's why we do it.
Yeah. Cool.
And the French oak is a much tighter grain. Well, not much, but it's a tighter grain than the American oak. In Hungarian,
so you're
not
leaking and.
No. It's not leaking, as it were. It's more.
But it's not.
It's more the ingress and egress of flavor in and out.
Yes,
So the tighter grain means that you're not picking up oak character, but you might get barrel character in beer, but it's not oak character.
Yeah.
I'm not after making oaky beer.
No. And the second question I had is, do you call your fermenters cool ships, or and do you want to explain?
Not at all.
Explain why?
So a cool ship is a wide, shallow vessel made specifically for spontaneous fermentation. So hot wort at boiling temperatures goes into a cool ship and it inoculates. So and it cools overnight and during that cooling process.
Because there's like a bigger surface area and it cools quicker,
exactly.
And etc.
It cools overnight. And this is how people cool down wort before heat exchangers or a number
of different
things.
Do, and
some people still do. Yeah, absolutely. That's not what we're doing here.
Yeah.
The fermenters that we have are wide and shallow, but for a totally different reason.
But they're not open either, are they?
No, they're not. Mm. So we inoculate with our culture. So we pitch the culture that we have. But they're wide and shallow because these yeasts are very, very responsive to hydrostatic pressure. Hydrostatic pressure is the pressure that you feel the deeper you go down to the ocean.
Okay.
It's the pressure of the weight. Sorry, I'm a physicist, so I should be like...
But like the pressure of water, right? Like,
it's the weight of what's on top of you the pressure that...
So if you have your typical conical fermenter...
Cylindrical conical fermenter...
The hydrostatic pressure on the bottom of that
would
be quite high.
The yeast cells literally get exploded.
Yeah.
They get burst because of that pressure. And for these types of yeasts, sort of Belgian estuary yeasts, which is generally what you get in wild captures as well, instead of the super clean Chico or lager yeast, hydrostatic pressure will not allow them. It will suppress the ester production.
Is it phenols as well as esters?
We're probably more after esters and phenols, but they're both very important parts of the flavors of our beer. So the less beer you have on top of your beer, so the more surface area you have, the better, as the adage goes, the better the yeast is able to express its own character. Something that I picked up while I was traveling in Belgium and was just really dumbfounded by seeing... You know, I went to Brasserie de la Seine and Yvan de Beats there, the fantastic beer historian and brewer at de la Seine. He had designed these really shallow, wide UFO-looking fermenters for his beer, and they do their primary there for 5 or 6 days, and then they go into guard tanks, storage tanks, for them to mature for another few months before he packages them. And I mean, if you've ever had a de la Seine beer, you can, especially fresh, like you can attest to their immediate complexity. They're amazing. I mean, Terrace Bulba is like That's probably my desert island beer.
I've never had any of these beers.
They're incredible.
It's the last. It's my last thing on my bucket list is actually getting over to Belgium.
Oh, you haven't been to Belgium?
I haven't, and I'm scared. Okay. I'm just going to die because I won't be able to stop drinking booze.
Like. Well, the thing is, like, most of the really good beers are 5% and 6% or whatever.
But I just,
like,
you won't be able to.
It's not like America where you're going soon.
It's funny that I'm actually more worried about going to Belgium than
18% beers. You know,
you'll be fine. Worried about going to America, especially North Carolina. Holy shit, this is good.
That's an amazing wine.
I don't know why I should see.
Hey, I think we should end this episode and drink the rest of this wine because this wine's pretty amazing.
Is there anything else you want to say?
Yeah, let me give a quick plug. So we're on the social medias, on the internet.
So everything came out the other day, and
so you're
really happy with the feedback?
Yeah, it's been great. So
content's amazing.
What Liam was saying, we've sort of begun sort of rolling out. This sounds so... I've written some blog posts, and my mate's taken some photos. So we're just kind of putting them up a little bit, and kind of telling our story in the way that I want to tell it. So that's what we're doing right now. So we've got a website. It's called wildfirebeer.com, where you can go to AU, and it'll divert you back to back.com. And same thing on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter as well. It's just Wildfire Beer. And along those things, if you follow them before you open and as we continue, I just want to be really, really clear about what we're doing. So you're going to have information about the beer that we make, why we make the beer that we make, the process that it takes to make the beer that we do, the cultures that are in what we have, and to follow the same development that we'll be doing. I mean, again, I've been entrusted with this knowledge. And with these techniques, and so I really want to give them to other people and spread that word. So that's what I'll be exploring on the website, on the blog, and on the Twitter and the Instagram. So if you're interested in what we're doing, follow along, and it should be a fun ride.
Awesome. And when the time's right and you open the doors, can people just rock up or?
Yes, you absolutely can. I mean, when the time is right, we're going to use Eventbrite for the ticketed sort of tasting sessions, and the details are on the website there for that. So we'll open that a few weeks before we actually do it, before we actually open, and then once we open, you can either come. I mean, I'll be here every time we're open, so we're just going to open on Saturdays to start. Because I'm a control freak, so I want to make sure that people are getting the right information. No, so we'll open in the mornings for the tasting session only, which is like a 2-hour thing, and then we'll open for a few hours in the afternoon,
like a public session.
We're gonna be limited, and we are limited to the amount of people that we can have. So we're gonna do the right thing by all of our consents and make sure that we're not operating outside of our means or our license.
Hey, if you need a security guy.
Yeah, you're going to be great.
no one fucks with Adrian.
the vibe here is really more going to be like, taste a few beers, because we're going to be opening bottles, taste a few beers. If you want to take something home, we'll have bottles here for you to buy. The table beer is only going to be sold and drunk here.
Yeah.
So I mean, you could take a bottle home, but we're not sending that out to trade because it's really something special us. I feel like I need to prep people about this, whole thing, and also it's really personal, like why we make that beer. So if you want that, you need to come here.
Yeah. It's kind of like it harks back to
earn it. Not at all.
In a way, a little bit it is, right?
No, I just want to explain why we do this.
But I mean that the table beer harks back to Belgian brewing, right?
Absolutely.
The traditional Belgian brewers would make a table beer that you can only have there you just chill out. And,
yeah.
I mean, are you gonna do any food here, anything, or? We'll some see. Charcuterie or we'll something.
Food trucks.
I'd love to. We'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not trying to be cloying or cagey.
You just haven't figured it out yet.
There's a lot of things. I'd love to do that. I'd love to make this a place where you could drink wild fermented beer and natural wine, and have awesome cheese and cheese and charcuterie from New South Wales, like
funky salami.
Because that's exactly what I love. Like, right? That's what I want to do on my Friday, Saturday, Tuesday, any day really, night. We'd love to do that. We want to play by the rules. So we're gonna make sure that we're able to do those things before we do.
Of course,
The moment. We'll open just being just selling our beers, and there won't be any wine or anything like that. But if I rock up
with a giant fucking cheese plate, that's gonna be okay.
Yeah, you can bring
your
food. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'll share it with you.
Yeah. Sticky Bishops is just the road, and they have a holy goat.
Yes,
that's amazing. It's amazing from Victoria.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't had that.
You are on the out. Yeah. One last plane.
On that note,
so let's wrap it up.
Thanks, Dave's Brewery Tours, for sponsoring the podcast. Dave. I love Dave's. Thanks, Topher, for having us at your warehouse across from the Factory Theatre, which I think we heard some sound check earlier.
it's finished. There's something pretty cool going on.
It's a really cool...
You're gonna get busy, dude, before concerts.
Dude,
you're gonna need Adriano, the security guard here. Because
what's your fee?
Give me a bottle
an hour. I think it's a good rate.
Give me a bottle of your blend.
I think I probably figured it out.
I work for beer, don't you know that? that's my going fee. Thanks, Topher.
Thanks for coming.
Having us here.
Really appreciate it.
That was a really cool conversation.
Really cool conversation. Really cool beers.
Thank you.
I'm so excited about the final product.
I'm honestly very humbled in a lot of ways that people are interested in what we're doing, and that y'all are happy to spend the time doing this. So thank you for coming.
We'll be here on opening day. We'll be number one and number two outside.
Yeah.
I don't camp out for beers, but I will come.
I'm not going to tell Lee. I'm not going to tell Lee or Tom or Brad or anything about this. They don't listen to the podcast anyway, so it's fine.
Not the end of the podcast.
Probably the first 3 minutes. Yeah, and I'm done. Yeah. Too many planes.
Anyway, cheers.
Awesome. Cheers.
Thanks.